From Birmingham, Alabama, this is ARC Stories Radio. The stories that you're about to hear are true, personal, and told in front of a live audience at one of our ARC Stories events by the people who live them.
Sunday morning, around 10:15, 10:17, 10:21, this gargantuan blast shook our house on Dynamite Hill.
I'm Taylor Robinson, and today, in celebration of Black History Month, we have three stories all about growing up in Birmingham during the Civil Rights era.
It was 11 of us. We were from different colleges there. Got on that bus, and our goal was not to get arrested or beaten up until we got to Birmingham.
We created ARC Stories to give Birmingham a place to tell its stories to the world. So, coming up after the news, Birmingham's own true stories. Welcome to ARC Stories Radio. I am Taylor Robinson, ARC Stories Director, and I'm joined by my co-host and story coach, Chris Kinsley.
In honor of Black History Month, we have three stories from an event we produced in partnership with the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, where our theme was Marching On, Stories About Growing Up in the Civil Rights Era. One is about a very personal encounter with the infamous Bull Connor, and another about a Playboy agitator who used to cause a ruckus on Birmingham radio.
One of the privileges of being a part of ARC Stories is that we have the honor of being curators of all these stories that people tell. Many of them are very personal, and a few of them even provide firsthand accounts of significant moments in history. And that's why I'm excited about today's program, especially this first story. It's about an event in Birmingham that literally shaped our future, as well as the future of our country. Only you've never heard it from this point of view. Here's storyteller Ricky Powell.
In the 1960s, I was a 10th grader at Samuel Lohman High School. I lived on what some people will remember as Dynamite Hill, because during the Civil Rights Movement, this was where most of the bombings took place, with exceptions of sometimes out in Collegeville at Bethel, and sometimes over on the other side of Center Street, over by Bush Boulevard. Friday morning, the 13th of September, 1963, I got up as usual, did the little rituals that I would do, and I walked up to catch the bus to go to school on the south side. Well, I didn't have any tension on the bus that I was on because it was a bus that catered to a Black community. And even when we got downtown to transfer to the special, it took me to Ullman High School on the south side, which is now UAB. That Friday the 13th, uneventful, fortunately, was a day typical. Things went on as normal. And Friday evening, as we got on the bus going back, my friend Cynthia Wesley said, well, we'll talk over the weekend. And so I was cool with that. We rode the bus home, got on home. Saturday, typical, as you know, doing chores around the house. Your mother has you doing the, what husbands call the dear list things. Yes, dear, okay. Okay, mom was what I was saying. And I did them. And so finally I decided I was gonna call a friend, my road dog, Cynthia Wesley. And as I called her, she didn't really want to talk to me, but that was very strange because we talked about everything. I could talk to her and ask her about girls, and she in turn would ask me about boys. I mean, as limited as that was about me, I didn't know nothing about no boys. All I knew about was me. But I tried to tell her what I knew. And so she then invited me to go to church with her the following morning, which was September the 15th, 1963, a gray, overcast morning. And so I was on the phone with her that Saturday night. And so here I was. Yeah. I'm sure I can go with you. My mother was sitting right close to me. What time do you want me to be ready? Okay, I can do that. I can do that. No problem. Oh, no, I don't have to ask. Okay. Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'll talk to you then. Some mother, when I got off the phone, said to me, I need you to go with me to a funeral because, you know, times are very, very tense and people are not doing like they need to do or should do. And I don't want to be out stranded somewhere, and if something happens, I don't have any help, and maybe you can get away and run and get me some help. It was a very strange and tedious time because at that time, white men were dirty. They would do a lot of dirty things, and I could not understand, as a little boy, 15 years old, how some of these men who were the men who made decisions for a city, the ones who made all the plans for the city, could implement things that could be so ugly to children. So I couldn't go. But anyway, Sunday morning, around 10:15, 10:17, 10:21, this gargantuan blast shook our house. Now, as I said, as I started out, I lived on Dynamite Hill, which is from 16th Street Baptist Church, 16 blocks west. Then when you get to Center Street, you go up to 13th Avenue, and that's another 12 blocks. Well, my house shook like it was toilet paper. It was the blast was so strong, and I live in a brick house, and it's so strong that it just shook our house. Well, we thought, as always, trying to think the best, that maybe it was East Thomas Foundry, Fairfield Foundry blasting for ore so they can make steel. I mean, I know you all realize, some of you anyway, that we used to be the steel manufacturers of the world because we had all five of the elements needed to make steel. I knew that in the fifth grade. My teacher taught me that, so, you know, hey, I had some education. But at any rate, the blast went off. It shook. Wow, that's a big blast. Well, I don't know how many of y'all realize this. Now, this may be a shock to you. Back in the 1960s, Birmingham, Alabama, and even the state of Alabama, only had two channels, 13 and 6. Okay? So on television came this news flash. 16th Street Baptist had been bombed. 16th Street Baptist Church had been bombed. What? And I was going to be there? Oh, my God. And all of a sudden, they started doing this breaking news, and they had pictures, moving pictures of these people coming out of the side of the church. And I told my mom, I said, Mom, that's Carol Robinson they're bringing out under the cover on that gurney. And then he brought out some other people. Well, we couldn't find Cynthia. They couldn't find Cynthia all day long. They could not find Cynthia. Where is Cynthia? Finally, Mr. Marshall, who was one of the members of 16th Street Baptist Church, was going down through the church, pulling back rubble, trying to find his children, who were also a part of the children's program that they were having at that church that morning. And as he did that, Cynthia Wesley's head rolled into his hands. My dear friend had been decapitated. Wow. What is this? I'd never really known a childhood friend to die, not even from asthma or whatever childhood illnesses or anything, but to be killed because she was in church that Sunday morning. So the day went on, and there was news because I lost two other friends. One was Carol Robinson. The other was Denise McNair. Denise McNair, I understand, had a piece of cinder block in her head like that. It was standing out like a horn. Carol Robinson, they didn't really describe how she looked in death, but it must have been something terrible because she was dead. And the sad story that I remember during that period of time was Addie and Judy Collins. That Sunday morning, they were skipping and dancing and having a good time on their way to church to serve the Lord. In spite of all the problems that we were having in Birmingham, the state of Alabama, and the United States, these little girls were enjoying themselves. And little did they know that it would be their last chance to romp and play. The saddest part about Addie Collins' recognition was the little girl who had been playing with her, Junie, was the one who had to identify her. And even today, she still has not gotten over the shock. And I'm almost certain that I would not have been able to get over it either, because it had to be devastating. Here one minute you're playing, and here the next moment you're gone. There were many times during the course of these years that I have existed that I have wondered, what would my friend have become had she lived? Would she have been president of NBC in New York? Would she have been a teacher extraordinary? I mean, I did okay. I got a chance to perform on Broadway. I got a chance to travel all around the world and perform. And she was smarter than me, so I'm sure she would have gone farther. But the sadness is, I never knew. The sadness was, I didn't have any closure, because I didn't ever get a chance to see her with a closed casket. But in spite of it all, our trip must continue, and we must be strong and diligent to make sure that those kind of things don't happen to us again. Not that we do it to ourselves. Now, countries outside of America, they might do anything, just like they did 9/11. But all of us who live in the same country, we don't need to do that no more. We need to try to get along. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe that we shall overcome someday.
Ricky Powell is a Broadway and jazz vocalist. In 2001, he was inducted into the Alabama Jazz Hall of Fame.
The bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church is probably the most well-known event, not only in Birmingham's history, but from the entire civil rights era. When it comes to well-known people of that time, there are so many heroes we could name. Martin Luther King Jr., James Bevel, or Fred Shuttlesworth. Well, our next story is about one such hero and her face-off with one of the greatest villains of this era, Bull Connor. That's in a minute on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories.
This is ARC Stories Radio. We're bringing you true personal stories told live in front of an audience. Today's program, in honor of Black History Month, features stories about growing up during the civil rights era right here in Birmingham. I'm Taylor Robinson, the director of ARC Stories.
And I'm Chris Kinsley, story coach with ARC Stories. The Freedom Rides of 1961 were organized by civil rights activists who would ride buses throughout the South to protest the Southern states' refusal to desegregate public buses. One of the greatest opponents of the Freedom Rides was Bull Connor, Commissioner for Public Safety here in Birmingham. Our next storyteller was one of those Freedom Riders who took on Bull Connor directly.
In fact, when I was preparing for the event where this was recorded, I told her I was going to introduce her as a foot soldier in the civil rights movement. But she looked me dead in the eyes and said, "Oh no, honey, I was a general."
So here's storyteller and general, Catherine Birks Brooks.
I'm going to start my story in Nashville, Tennessee. Although my story starts about 70 years ago, but I'm going to start in Nashville. When we heard that Core was giving up the Freedom Ride, and we said no. We didn't want the Freedom Ride to stop. We there in Nashville was known as the Central Committee, a few of us, and we were having this picnic celebrating some victory that we had. We had integrated the lunch counters there, the theaters, and we had also integrated some churches. We used to have what we call pray-ins. So my girlfriend and I, Lucretia Collins, we went back to the dormitory to pack a few things and went and talked with our with the women advisor to tell her what we were going to do. Now, she knew that not to try to talk us out of it because, like I said, we had integrated Nashville. So she told Lucretia, since I'm originally from Birmingham, she said, have Catherine's mother to invite you to Birmingham, and therefore both of you will be leaving the campus legally. So I called my mama, and she did. And in the meantime, Diane Nash was our chairman at the time. Diane called Reverend Shuttlesworth to tell him that we were on our way and that we felt that the Freedom Ride must go on. It couldn't stop. And Reverend Shuttlesworth told her that he felt that it was too dangerous for us to come. She told Reverend Shuttlesworth she didn't call to get his permission. We were like that. We were not turning back. And she told him that we were coming. She was calling to tell him that we were on our way. And so that next morning, I guess around 8, 9 o'clock, it was 11 of us. We were from different colleges there. Got on that bus, and our goal was not to get arrested or beaten up until we got to Birmingham. But we were on our way to New Orleans. My boyfriend at the time, Paul Brooks, and Jim Sword, you may have heard of Jim Sword. Jim Sword was a white fella that was with us. They decided that they were not going to do what we all had agreed to do. They had a seat together on the front seat on this Greyhound bus. And we didn't have a charter bus now. This was a regular Greyhound bus. So, all right. The rest of us just scattered ourselves throughout the bus. Fast forward then a little bit, we get to the city line of Birmingham. And guess what happens? Mr. Bull stops the bus. Eugene Bull comes. He stops the bus. He told Paul and Jim Sword to separate. They refused to separate. Paul refused to go to the back, and Jim refused to get up. So he told one of his men, said, all right, arrest him. Take him off the bus, and they did. He allowed the rest of us to come on into Birmingham. When we got to Birmingham, the first one stepped back up on the bus was that old bull again. So he said, I want to everyone else get off and the Freedom Riders stay on. So we all got up to get off. We didn't have on anything saying that I'm a Freedom Rider. We thought we had the bull then. He said, everyone have a seat. I want to see your tickets. And all of us that had a ticket from Nashville to New Orleans, he said, stay on the bus. He kept us on the bus, and the rest can get off. So they kept us on the bus for maybe about 2 hours or more, and Bull kind of had them to put paper on all of the windows of the bus. So the outsiders that had gathered around couldn't see us. And even my mother had, which I didn't know it at that time, was down there trying to see if she could see me. Bull let us off, and of course, the blacks went straight to the white waiting room, and the one white girl that we had now went straight to the black waiting room. And we stayed there in the bus station, I guess, for maybe about a couple of hours. Here come the bull again. He told us that we were all under arrest. And he said it was for our protection. Protected custody, I think that was he called it. So, of course, we didn't fight him. He had the power. We went right on. He carried us to the city jail. And by now, you know, it's getting dark and it's almost bedtime. But it was still early. When we walked in and they put us with the regular people that was in jail, and the ladies was playing cards, and Lucretia and I love to play cards, so we asked them if we could play cards with them, and then they said yes, and so we introduced ourselves, told them about the movement and about why we were there and what they need to be doing and how many times we had been arrested. I had been arrested once in Birmingham, and I think it was at Lummer's. Yeah, at Lummer's lunch counter, and I'd been arrested 4 times there in Nashville. So, you know, being in jail was no big thing with us, because I knew I was going to either have to take the floor or the top bunk. And we played a few hands and took the top bunk and went on to sleep. And that next morning, got up for breakfast, and then the next night, the warden came in, the guard, and she told Lucretia and I to put our clothes on. You all leaving here. And she didn't say where the bull was taking us. But then, just before we got out of the jail, we heard that the bull was taking us back to Nashville. And we had always been taught that if you don't want to participate, then you go limp. So I stretched out on the floor. And Bull had one of his policemen to pick me up and carry me out of the jail to the limousine that was going to take us back to Nashville. Now that limousine sure did look good. And I think that was the first time that I was that close to a limousine. But I didn't let it on now. No. And we knew what we was going to do as soon as we got back to Nashville. We knew what we was going to do. So in the limousine, I was on the front seat in the middle. Bull was on one side over by the window and the driver. And in the back, that was John Lewis, Lucretia Collins, and a man from the Birmingham News. I don't know his name. and everything was calm and cool, and Bull and I started the conversation. And it was not a hostile conversation. It was smooth. No one was screaming or howling or coughing. And when we got to Coleman, Bull said, "I better pull these curtains." He said, "Because you know you all not supposed to be up in Coleman this time of morning." Well, it may have been probably about 2 o'clock, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Now, you know there was no curtains on this in this limousine. You know, he was making a joke about the curtains. Coleman used to be a mess. Yeah, a triple mess. And Coleman was a sundown town. And some of you young folks may not know what I'm talking about when I say a sundown town. That meant that if you were black, you better be out of there by the time the sun go down. Mm-hmm. Unless somebody knew you awful well, or you was coming out of one of those houses that you were working up in there. The conversation went on, and I invited the Bull to have breakfast with us. Yes, at Tennessee State. No, not at Tennessee State, but down on Fisk campus, because Tennessee State School, he couldn't have gone in the cafeteria there to have any food. And he agreed. Yes, he said that he would eat breakfast with us. When we got to the state line, all of a sudden, and I didn't know it was the state line, where we were on these tracks, railroad tracks, the car stops. Bull tells the policeman to put our bags out, throw the bags out. And he pointed to a building. He said, "That's a train station over there. And you all can get a train back to Nashville." Now here I'm thinking, I'm leaning back and everything and running my mouth. He's thinking I'm going on into Nashville in this car. Now I got to get a train back to Nashville. So I could let the Bull have the last word. So I hollered at the Bull before the doors on the car closed, and I knew he heard me. I said, "We'll see you back in Birmingham by high noon." That's the only thing I could think of that was strong enough without cursing. And you young people may not know what I meant by high noon. But see, long time ago on those two channels that we had, two TV channels, we used to watch a lot of cowboy movies. And if anything was going down, if somebody done the wrong thing, you better be out of town by high noon, or you know what's going to happen. Behind the old corral. And so then we said, "Oh." We walked on over to this building that we thought was a train station. It was no one in that building, no lights on, the doors were locked. And you know what went through our minds then? That the Klan was coming. So we stood next to the building, had another meeting. So we all decided then that we would stay together and just walk down the tracks, because we knew that if we ran up on some houses on the tracks, usually there would be some white folks on one side and black folks on the other side, because we could tell the difference from usually that the type of houses that the black live in and the types that the whites live in. And so after maybe about 30 minutes or so, we did find some houses. And we looked over there, we looked and said, "Oh, that's where the blacks live, right over there." And so true enough, that was where the blacks live. We knocked on the door. The man came to the door. Now it's about, it's about 4 o'clock in the morning. And we explained to him what had happened, what Bull Connor had done to us, and we want to use his phone because we need a car to get back to Birmingham by high noon. That's what we want to call our office, to get a car. And so he was a little afraid. We could understand that, because if they'd have found out that he had helped us, you know what was going to happen to him. But I thought about what my mother had always said. Always talk, try to talk to the lady in the house if you need some help. So I said, you all, let's talk loud and wake up his wife. And we did. And I could close my eyes and hear those locks coming off the door now and hear her saying, let them children in this house. That's right. And then I ran right to the phone, and we had someone in our office 24 hours. Called back to the office, Diane was there, and we told her what had happened. And she told us that she had heard, of course, that we had been arrested. And another group, they had got another group together. And that group was on their way, another group of Freedom Riders out of Nashville was on their way into here. Some was coming by train, some coming by bus. And a group out of Atlanta, Georgia. One of our members borrowed another member's mother's car. And we are all so thankful to her, and she was a white woman. Let him use her car to come and get us from Ardmore, Alabama, and to carry us back to Birmingham. So we was trying to get here before high noon. And one of our fellows didn't live that far from there, and so he knew some back roads that we could take getting back to Birmingham. And we heard on the news that Commissioner Bull Connor has taken care of the Freedom Riders. We learned later that he had even told President Kennedy that he had taken care of, sent us back to Nashville, and we was on our way back to Birmingham. And so we didn't do anything but laugh. And so when we got in Birmingham, of course, me being from Birmingham, not that far from where Reverend Shuttlesworth lived, and I knew some back roads to take to Reverend Shuttlesworth's house, and we went to his house. Well, when, of course, by this time, he knew we were coming because Diane had called and told him, and they were saying on the radio that we were on our way to Nashville, and we were in Birmingham. And we went to back to the bus station. And Bull was not there. As a matter of fact, I never did see him again. But we stayed in the bus station for something like 18 hours. No bus driver would drive us, saying that they were saying that they were not going to give up their lives for some niggas. So I understand later that President Kennedy told the Greyhound bus people that they were going to fly a black soldier in here, and he would drive the bus. They found the bus driver, and we had all the protection that we needed leaving Birmingham. Policemen on both sides, back and front, helicopter and airplane. Oh, yes, I leaned back and I dozed off. Sure did. I dozed off. And I'm going to stop right there, and the rest of it is history.
We shall not be moved. We shall not.
In addition to being a civil rights activist, Catherine Burks Brooks has also been a teacher, social worker, and newspaper editor. PBS's American Experience produced a documentary on the Freedom Riders featuring Catherine, and you can find a link to it on our website, arcstories.com.
We might think of civil rights protesters as people who marched in the street, but in our next story, our teller takes to the airwaves in order to rally for the cause. That's next on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own True Stories.
Thanks for joining us for ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's true stories told by the people who lived them and recorded in front of a live audience. I'm story coach Chris Kinsley.
And I'm ARC Stories director Taylor Robinson. Today we're featuring stories from an event we produced with the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, where our theme was Marching On, stories about growing up in the civil rights era. And our next teller is no stranger to using the airwaves to celebrate all that was being done for civil rights. However, that doesn't mean his opponents made things easy for him. Here's storyteller Shelley Stewart.
In 1941, I left Rosedale and came into this country as a homeless kid because of abuse there in Rosedale. But before I left, there was a lady there that taught the first grade. She said, if you get a good education, if you learn to read, you can become anything you want to be. That was my first great teacher, Mamie Laban Foster. I found myself out on Euclid Avenue. I found my older brother who left home 2 years prior. Something carried me to that area, and I was in Crestline Village and walked down Euclid Avenue, and before dark, I was going to hide out in a horse stable, and that was Stringfellow Stables, owned by Earl Martin Stringfellow. I had Stringfellow Lumber Company out in Bessemer. I didn't know who they were naturally, but I saw that barn and I decided I was gonna sneak in there that night and hide. But lo and behold, I found my brother was in that same barn, had been there 2 years. I would walk from Euclid Avenue because the closest colored school was Irondale. There was the Irondale Colored School, but Stringfellow Stables there, middle of Euclid Avenue. I wanted to go to school. I had gone to the first grade and I was 7 years of age. I'm supposed to go to school in September, but that for school up there was 5 miles. But Bubba, my oldest brother, said, Shirley, if you want to go to school, man, you walk. And so I walked each day from Stringfellow Stables up to Irondale Colored School. Did that from 1941, 42, 43. But one morning, 1943, a guy pulled up beside me on Euclid Avenue in a beautiful green Packard automobile. He happened to be a man who was white. And he said, I've been watching you walk into school every day. You want to go to school that bad, boy? I said, yes, sir. He says, I tell you what, I live near Irondale Colored School. If you want to, I will let you stay in my basement and you can go over there to that school. I told Bubba that I would go there and I wanted to go to school, so I took him up on it. I went in and began living in that basement. He hid me there. No one knew that he had this new Negro boy living in the basement. They couldn't tell anyone I was there. I couldn't tell people. I would slip through the woods, go to school, come back and walk over into the bin. That's the Negro section of Irondale. I would go there to sit and watch, but people didn't know who I was. But in that house, they told me, Shelley, you are a very smart fella. You're a good boy. And they said something to me, said, it takes both the black and the white keys on the piano to play the Star Spangled Banner. And I looked at him and didn't understand that. But each day I would go to school and I kept going, going, going. And they would tell me, you don't have to be afraid of anyone. Don't let anyone tell you that you're less than. You are a human being. And I held that in my heart. I got busted at that house at the age of 13, had to leave. I took up and I ended up in Collegeville. And I had to ride the special to Parker High School. Well, you would take this only Negro high school in Birmingham at that time. And I got on 22 Boyle's Tarrant City. And I got on the streetcar there at that stop there. And the streetcar driver had that board. It was all the way almost in the back. It was about 4 seats back there for the Negro section colored. There's colored white board there. And the front of the streetcar was empty. And the ladies were getting on that street, gotten on that streetcar in Inglenook and over there in Boyles and there in East Birmingham. And these ladies were standing up there all back behind this board. And something told me, for whatever reason, these ladies needed a seat. And I was 16 years old. I got up and put that board and carried up about five seats. The streetcar driver, he put that thing and stopped it and said, "Boy, move that board back in there." I said, "No, sir." And I asked the ladies, "Y'all come and sit down." They were afraid. But there's something happened. I don't know who that man is. I have not seen him since. But there was a man who looked like me. He saw what I had done. He told that streetcar driver, "Say, you go back up there, and ladies, y'all come sit down." Boy, thank you for doing that. Those ladies took the seats there on that streetcar. I moved that board when I was 16 years old because I thought it was the right thing to do. Bad habit I had, I guess. I carried that bad habit on through high school. I learned to do lots of things and became a radio personality. Shelley the Playboy. And I was very popular. And for some reason, I had people from all of Birmingham coming to here, see this guy. And I would go on the air at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I would see young girls coming in from Phillips High School, Parker High School. They would, "Oh my Lord, he's a playboy." Yeah. So they gave me the name Shelley the Playboy. With that being said, I caused a lot of problems in Birmingham as a radio personality. The records were show. What I did, I didn't have any particular reason. I just thought it was the right thing to do. I would talk to people, not to black people, not to white people, but to people. And 1957, I was on the air, and all of a sudden, people called and said, "Hey, Shelley, you're losing your signal." And I said, "Losing my signal? What are you talking about?" "Well, we can't hear you." And so I got on the thing, and the tower was out there on Denison Avenue, WEDR radio station. And I called the engineer. "Engineer, listen, they say we're losing power." Well, engineers all had to be white during that time. No Negro engineers, no Negro salespeople. But I said, "We're losing power." He said, "Well, we are." I said, "Why are we losing power?" "Well, they're cutting the tower down because what you saying?" I said, "Well, why don't you go, who's cutting?" He said, "The KKK. I said, "Well, why don't you go out there and stop them?" He said, "I can't, I'm one of them." I said, "Why don't you stop them?" He said, "I can't, I'm one of them." So sure enough, I get in the car and drive over there, and there the tower was on the ground out there. Well, that was just one, but I had been warned anyway because I had come to the station once and they had KKK written on the windows, but I continued to do what I did. It didn't stop me from being that. Eugene Bull Connor, that boy, he was always on my case, I can tell you. He wouldn't call me Shelley the Playboy, he called me Shelley the Plowboy, you know. But I can tell you, I learned later that Bull Connor did something. There was a White Citizens Council meeting. Y'all didn't know about White Citizens Council, did you? Well, that was a group called White Citizens Council. They didn't want to be called KKK, so we are White Citizens Council. That's a better name, you know, more acceptable name. I'm not a KKK, I'm a White Citizens Council. they had a meeting out there at a car lot in North Birmingham. And the White Citizens Council meeting, Bull was out there, and so they had a little thing, says, "Well, that Shelley the Playboy, he's a troublemaker in this town. He is up there, he's saying things, he's got a big mouth. I tell you, never heard anything like it in my life. We got to do something to him and get him off the air." So they said, "Yeah, Shelley does have a big mouth. He's talking to, he's got these fan clubs, these white boys, white girls listening to him." Says, "We got to do something." Says, "Bull, what we need to do, make an example out of him. We need to kill him." Well, they thought about it, and Bull, I was not there, by the way. one of the KKK, I'm sorry, White Citizen Council members, told me what happened there. So he told me, says, Shelley, says, the bull came to your defense. I said, what did he do? So Bull stood up and told him, said, well, Shelley got a big mouth. We should make an example. But if we do anything to Shelley, it's going to cause a serious problem in Birmingham. Said, so you see, if you bother some other people, colors may not act up. Said, but if you bother Shelley, the playboy, he got a lot of white folks, so he's going to have some uprising with some white folks and colored folk too. So let's not kill him. Because he's got some white folks and colored folk working together. And I can tell you right now, another thing happened to me during that period in the air and in Birmingham. In 1960, I got real bold, dumb, I guess. I didn't know any better, I guess. But a group of my fans who happened to be white wanted me to perform for them on a disco. We call them discos now, but they platter parties, record hops during that time. It was a place called Don's Teen Town. And I was to appear, and I appeared there. So I said, I'll play for you. Certainly, I'll appear. I'm just, you know, I'm a radio personality. I'll appear. I have no problem playing for people who are white. I'm going to play. So I go out, and I get my little group, and I go out, and I said, this is going to be good. I'm doing something here in Birmingham, Alabama. I'm going to break this thing. I'm going to have some, all these kids are coming out to see Shelley the Playboy. And so I go out there with my record stuff, and I set up, and boy, we playing, get out of that bed and wash your face and hand, you know, you know, shake, rally, and roll. It was good stuff. But anyway, I'm out there, about 800 children, 800 of these teens. They fill that place. And I'm up there on stage, man, we just rock. All of a sudden, Ray Mahoney, the owner, comes up and says, Shelley, cut the music, cut it now. I said, what's wrong, Ray? He says, out there, they're burning a cross out there, and they want us to send you outside. And I said, you kidding? He said, no. Look outside, see that fire burning up there? And I looked at the window. The children didn't know what was going on yet. And sure enough, that cross was being burned. And I said, Ray, what are we going to do? He said, what are we going to do? I'm going to just tell the children what's happening. So he goes to the microphone and says, boys and girls, the KKK is out there. They don't think the Shelley's good enough to play for us, so we got to cut the party. And those kids just like hell. And this is true story. Those kids, they bolted out of the door, went outside and jumped on the KKK. Yeah, I'm sorry. They out there fighting these white kids, out there fighting, and me up there, I'm looking, so ooh-wee. what a fight going on out here, you know? Yeah. And when they said, Shelley, why are we doing this? You can get away. And I was able to get away and let me escape. And I was headed into Birmingham, and sure enough, one of the disc jockeys on WSGN radio made it a, Shelley the Playboy has been killed by a white mob. So those things that happen. But ladies and gentlemen, I'll be honest with you. I still say it's about bringing people together. There was a man who came to me in 1963. He said, Shelley, we can't get the adults in Birmingham to march for freedom, not for integration, but for freedom, the rights of people. We never talked about any civil rights. We talked about human rights, rights of all human beings. And he said, what would you do? Would you mind, could you get on the air? You and Tall Paul, would y'all actually get on the air and ask and get the teenagers, turn them out? His name was James Bevel. James Bevel was one of the great people with Martin Luther King Jr. So in 1963, because of, well, Tall Paul and Shelley Stewart, one or two more, not all, we saw a need, not because of really doing the wrong thing, but I had a bad habit of doing the right thing. And so therefore, I believed what I did in using the coded messages and being a part in turning the children out to march in 1963. We shall overcome someday. Thank you.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Shelley Stewart is a former radio personality and station owner, and now he's an advertising executive. You can learn more about his fascinating life by reading his memoir, The Road South. If you've enjoyed today's stories, we'd love to have you join us to hear more at our next live event. It's coming up Saturday night at the Avon Theater. Our theme will be Crazy Little Thing, stories about love and relationships. Our last event was standing room only, so we encourage you to get your tickets ahead of time. You can get all the details at arcstories.com.
Thanks for listening to ARC Stories Radio. This program is produced in partnership with WBHM. We especially need to thank Michael Crowell, Program Director at WBHM, as well as Audrey Adkins, Marketing Manager, Will Dahlberg, Membership Manager, and Rachel Lindley, News Director. The General Manager for WBHM is Scott Hanley. Recording and mastering was by Eric Chapman from Symmetric Sound. Upper Air Creative does all of our design, and Territory 3 provides our website. If you like today's stories, please subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on our website, arcstories.com. There you can listen to other stories, you can stay up to date with all of our events, and you can even submit your own story. After all, we are always asking, what's your story?